Welcome to Parents' Perspective. What do you mean you're busy after school? 16-year-old Ralph cornered his girlfriend Carrie near her locker. Don't you remember? A bunch of us are going down to campaign headquarters to man the phone bank, Carrie replied. The phone bank? Ralph looked puzzled. What are you doing that for? Because, she gave him an annoyed look, we want to make a difference.
A difference? Ralph grimaced.
Why bother? Who cares who gets elected anyway?
You should, oh obtuse one, countered Carrie. If you paid any attention to the campaign, you'd know there's a big difference between the candidates.
Yeah, but you know they all say whatever they think we want to hear, and when they get elected, they just do what they want, Ralph responded.
Which is why we need to pay attention and hold them to their promises. Nobody's a king around here, you know.
Yeah, well, Ralph pulled his baseball glove out of his locker. When did a few people ever matter?
From a parent's perspective, how can we raise our kids to be informed citizens? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Our guest is greatly concerned with future citizens and their knowledge and values. Dr. Peter Levine is director of CIRCLE, the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement at the University of Maryland. Levine is the author of The Future of Democracy, Developing the Next Generation of American Citizens, three other scholarly books on philosophy and politics, and a novel. He's the proud father of two girls. Welcome to Parents' Perspective.
Thanks very much for having me.
What's the biggest myth we have as adults about our roles as citizens?
I think we probably treat them too narrowly, our roles as citizens. We think immediately of voting, which was in your story, and that's good. But there are so many different ways to change the world, to work with other people to change the world, including organizing things at the local level, volunteering, belonging to groups. And when you first ask people what are their civic responsibilities, you get kind of too short a list, I think. So we're not thinking about a broad enough set.
In your book, you mentioned a very interesting thing, a lot of interesting things, actually, but you mentioned an area of Chicago that was known to be sort of corrupt and not so great and had poverty and high minority populations and so forth. And you said this was a group that was really civically involved. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, well, Chicago actually has a great tradition going back to the 19th century of organizing citizen action at the grassroots level. And definitely it's not the case that your more affluent and richer suburban areas are the most engaged. I mean, they are in some ways. They're likely to have higher voter turnout. But a lot of the most powerful forms of civic participation in America have been from the poor. And some of our greatest examples are things like the civil rights movement.
And your point was, I think, in that part of the book, that if people see that they can get results on a much narrower, smaller scale, closer to them kind of level, then that stimulates their participation further.
I think it does. That's right. And if also if they get results in really practical ways, so people don't necessarily care about civic engagement. They care about problems like crime or poverty or homelessness or global warming. There's some evidence that public participation with the police in Chicago at the beat level, working in these beat level teams, actually cut the crime rate quite a bit. So that's the kind of thing I think that reinforces the value of civic participation.
As parents, what do you see as our function in raising kids to be grown-up citizens?
Well, parents have a powerful role. If you just ask kids whether their parents took them to vote, whether their parents volunteered, whether their parents talked to them about issues in politics, the ones who say yes are much, much more involved as adults. So parents have a powerful role. I think it's mostly modeling citizenship, but it's also partly actually deliberately talking about issues and values too.
Well, how early should kids be introduced to their responsibility to become informed citizens?
I want to answer by saying very early. I think there's no reason you can't talk to a three-year-old about some issues and about an election. I'm not a developmental psychologist, and I don't think that the evidence is all that strong about what the effects are of talking to somebody when they're four versus talking to them when they're 12. But certainly know from personal experience that you can talk to a 3 or 4 year old about issues.
What kinds of things do you talk to a 3 or 4 year old about?
Well, I mean, they're definitely, at least some 3 or 4 year olds are talking about the presidential campaign right now. They're not going to be thinking about the different candidates' health policy plans, but they're thinking about the life stories of the candidates, where they came from.
The people part of it.
The people part of it, yeah.
Uh-huh. How about the responsibility part of it? How do we encourage our children's sense of sort of responsibility to the larger group besides to their family?
And taking out the trash.
Right. Well, we right.
So we think we certainly have to model that. So it's not just what you say, it's what you do. And so parents who are showing responsibility are more likely to bring up kids who feel responsible. I do think that being given opportunities to make a difference, to serve, to help for teenagers is something that is very satisfying to them. Maybe not to every last one, but in general, they are going to like those opportunities and they're going to thrive. And so it's not so much a matter of having to force them into opportunities. Generally, the research shows if you, for example, give high school kids an opportunity for a valuable service program, they tend to actually like that better than the other things that you set up for them. I mean, they're going to like that more than math class. So I'm not sure that we have such a hard sell.
It's interesting. You were citing some statistics in your book about kids who do not participate in these kinds of programs, whatever they are much more likely to drop out of high school and to have drug use and to be teen parents and so forth and so on.
That's right. So I'm interested in developing people to be active citizens because I think that voting and participating is good in itself. There are a lot of people in my business who are in it for a different reason, which is that they know from statistics that if you want to cut teen pregnancy, reduce violence, improve test scores, one of the best ways is to give kids an opportunity to participate constructively. Many of them thrive. For example, it probably is the best way to cut teen pregnancy in the middle school years is to give young girls the opportunity to serve in constructive ways. And I think that's advice for parents, particularly if you're worried about how their teenager's doing in those years. One of the best things might be to get them involved in something where they can have a voice and make a difference.
Not always the easiest thing in the world to do when you have two parents working and not around maybe to drive to an activity or to pick up or to encourage as much as
absolutely.
Some would like.
No, I agree. So this, again, goes beyond anything I have an expertise on. But I wonder, especially if adolescents are having a difficult time at that period of life, I'm not sure parents are necessarily the best people to actually enroll the kid in the service program. It may be better if it comes out of a school or community-based group.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on raising informed citizens.
The popular new book, Raising a Successful Child, Discover and Nurture Your Child's Talents, by Sandra Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We are talking with Dr. Peter Levine about raising informed citizens. You were talking in your book about charter schools and how they would have an effect as well. Does this dovetail into this community service part?
Well, I like the idea of charter schools because the parents themselves can be involved in the governance of the school. If your kid is enrolled in a big bureaucratic school system, whether it's urban or suburban, it's hard for you as a parent to engage. I guess I want parents to be involved because I think you get better educational results, but also because it models involvement. To put it the other way, if we teach kids it's your responsibility to be involved, it's a democracy, as you said in your opening, there's no king around here, and yet the teachers and the parents in their school system, which they see every day, have no voice whatsoever because it's a tremendously bureaucratic, centralized, forbidding institution, then I don't think we're educating them for participation. So I would like both the teachers and the parents themselves feel empowered. Your question was about charter schools, and it seems to me because they're small and because they're set up by some group that has a charter, have some promise as a way of engaging parents. Although I'm not at all sure the evidence is that strong that they really do at this point.
Are those kinds of schools stronger on community service kinds of things because they're sort of grassroots?
Well, that's the hypothesis, and I don't think we know the answer. One of the things about the charters is they tend to have a theme. They tend to have a strong theme. So in Washington, D.C., there's the Cesar Chavez Charter School for Public Policy. So that fits my interest perfectly because all the kids spend their whole time working on public policy. They have a senior capstone project is in public policy. That's great. But, of course, the whole idea of charter schools is not that everybody does public policy. It's that everyone has a theme. So I do worry a little about what happens if you have a vocational theme or an arts theme and it's really very devoid of anything to do with social issues or politics. What we might end up doing is segregating our kids. So at ninth grade, picking a specialty high school already interested in politics goes to the Cesar Chavez school, ends up as mayor, and that's a great story. But what about the brother who was interested in mechanical engineering and doesn't end up anywhere near it? So there are pros and cons.
So it means that really no matter where the kids go to school, even though we're counting on the schools to have community service kinds of things, the parents need to have their eyes open to see that that occurs and pressure the schools to do that if it's not there.
That would be great. I don't think there's very much parental pressure for civic participation in schools. There are parents who care, but I don't think that's a principal or a superintendent sitting there in the office wondering about what will keep the parents happy, what will keep the parents electing to go to the school system, what will cause the parents to elect my school instead of somebody else's school if they have choice. I don't think any of them are thinking about civic outcomes at all, because I just don't think they're getting the message from parents that that's what parents want. I hope that people listening feel differently, but I don't think there's much of an organized voice. Generally speaking, I think parents are concerned about test scores and where you can go to college and safety and discipline maybe, which is fine and connects a little bit to civics, but is not the whole of civics.
Parents learn a lot, though, by their own involvement in a school. If they can make any time, sometimes it's just evening meetings or helping with some project on a weekend, but you learn a lot behind the scenes about how things are working where your child is going for an education.
Mm-hmm. No, you do, and that's one of the reasons that we want parents involved. But I'm worried that parents are involved, but they're not looking for whether their kid's getting civic or democratic opportunities. They're looking for whether their kid's getting learning math and reading, which is understandable.
So often parents feel, well, I'm sending my child to school. It's the teacher's responsibility. They kind of totally give up their own responsibility for the education. And you're saying, go for it.
Yeah, well, we live in a time of great specialization and consumer attitude towards everything. So the schools are supposed to be selling us education. They're supposed to do it. And so we just let them do it. But I think education is different from refrigerators. It's something that you have to be part of or it won't work.
Peter, what can we do to reduce teens' frequent cynicism? You know about teens, especially in light of national and local political scandals.
I don't think we want to just talk them out of being cynical. Not just simply say you have to be more positive. I mean, there are problems with the system, and some of the problems make me very angry. You know, there are problems in the behavior of particular leaders, but there are also ways that the system's set up. I mean, you tell kids they should vote, but at the same time, you've got congressional districts, only about 10% of them are even remotely competitive. They've been drawn on the map to prevent competition. So you're saying vote, but then you're also saying, by the way, this one candidate is guaranteed to win. So that's just an example of how the system rightly provoke some cynicism. I'd like the kids to be informed so they're cynical about the right things. There are conspiracy theories and stuff floating around, which we don't need because we have plenty to worry about based on facts. And then also I'd certainly like them to feel that there might be possible to reform the system, which we have done many times before in American history, which is possible to do. But if I'm talking to kids directly, I don't just dismiss the cynicism as if they're being teenagers and they should respect the system more. We've built a pretty lousy system for them, I think. Or at least we've built a mixed system.
But their cynicism can be turned around to be contributory.
Right. In fact, I want to challenge the premise a little bit because I'm not sure they're entirely more cynical than we are. I mean, it's a mix. Often you get really glib, cynical comments about formal politics. You also get very idealistic and possibly even naive thoughts about what people can accomplish working together. I mean, I myself am probably a little more pessimistic than I was when I was 18, and I think there's one reason that it's fun to work with teenagers is that in some ways they have a reservoir of optimism and idealism, which is more evident than it is among older people. There's also a bigger generational story because these kids' parents are often not baby boomers. They're often Generation Xers like me, and we had all the way through our lives extremely strong cynicism. So these kids tend to be more idealistic. At least as things are shaping up, it looks like their generation is more idealistic than the previous generation, which doesn't mean that it's more idealistic than their grandparents or their great-grandparents.
Do you want to discuss that a little bit? I know in your book you talked about an interesting combination now, a generational combination between the boomer generation, which is the college professors very often, and this younger generation, which is beneath Generation X. What is it called? Generation Y or something?
Okay. Sometimes we say the millennials.
Okay. Anyway, there's an interesting combination coming together.
I was mainly in that part writing about the college professors and their students. So it's one group. But I think it might be true a little of high school teachers and their students, which kind of misses, to a certain extent, my generation. It's the preponderance of college professors are boomers. So they went through this formative experience of campus unrest and conflict and Vietnam War, and then that was sobering for a lot of people because it didn't work out the way it was supposed to in many different ways. And then you've got the millennials coming up who have a very typically kind of genial, optimistic attitude towards life and are not at all revolutionary in their impulses, but tend to be basically pretty positive. And it makes for a lot of interesting experiments. You basically get the professor who went through the 60s but gave up on it, working with the millennials who seem to want to try the internet or try working on Darfur, and I think it leads to a lot of good experiments.
So what is happening out there? What are they doing together?
Well, there's an immense amount of engagement work in colleges, some of which is research on community issues, some of which is networking. A lot of it is international, kids working with kids in other countries. I'm talking mostly about college students. There's lots and lots of service learning, some of which is good and some of which is less so, but which involves doing community service as part of your coursework in college and writing about it. Also media production, kids making their own news, including I've just seen a bunch of proposals where kids in colleges are writing or producing hyper-local news media for the communities right around their colleges, partly as a part of an urban redevelopment strategy. So they get a really poor neighborhood or a stressed neighborhood, and the kids say, well, we could make a newspaper for this neighborhood. So there's just a ton of experimentation that's hard to summarize without just giving a long list.
That sounds very positive.
Yeah.
You started to allude to your generation, Generation X, and what you're doing with Generation Y, the millennials. How is that coming together?
Well, my best friends are my generation, but we were problematic in a way. One thing is we're a smallish group, just sheer size, and so tended to fall between the stools a little bit, and then certainly felt very cynical to start with. I think our formative influences were things like crack, AIDS, divorce, whereas the preceding generation had been bad things like a Vietnam War, but they had had all this exciting tumult and they'd felt like they were at the center. I mean, my school was still struggling with racial desegregation, but the big legal struggle and so forth had been right 10 years before me. So there was a feeling that we didn't have that much of a role and that things were not going very well. And so my generation has never really recovered as a particularly civic generation.
Well, what about parents who want to get the community at large involved in helping their kids have this kind of participation and feel this kind of positive input? What can parents do?
The thing that comes to mind, first of all, is the objective, which ought to be actually changing the priorities of schools. So there's less social studies in the curriculum than there used to be. There's kind of a marginal place for service and service learning. Extracurricular activities of all kinds are great for teaching kids to be participatory members of our society, and extracurriculars are often shrinking. And parents should be pushing for those things. They should be themselves supporting them, which they can do. I mean, you can help the extracurricular group by being the coach or being the parent rep, but you can also press school districts to make sure those are priorities. As I was mentioning before, I don't think that there is much pressure for those things from parents. I don't think that's what they're really looking for.
Now, there's a difference, right, between a kid being on the local soccer team and the kid doing community service to take food to the homeless.
There's a difference, and taking food to the homeless is probably more to the point of the things that I'm interested in. But I wouldn't rule out the soccer team, especially if it's pretty much a self-governing organization, because it's in those groups that kids learn fundraising, recruitment, selecting leadership, how do you deal with somebody who's not doing their part, which are all the kind of skills that we need for civil society, for organizational life. So we want kids to be in associations. Boys' sports have always been at least somewhat problematic from my point of view. It's not a prejudice, but the research is a little problematic because it seems as if boys and sports sometimes develop, I think especially the high-profile sports where they become local heroes for their performance on the field, there are not such great outcomes in terms of whether they're willing to serve and work with others. Girls' sports, very positive civic effects for girls.
Are there kinds of sports then that would be better for boys to be in than the high-profile kinds of things?
It might be. I don't think we know. But I do think there are different coaching styles that make a difference and also different ways that parents relate to coaches and teams. If it's all about winning and all about your kid getting time to play and your first response to not getting time to play is to yank your kid and those kinds of things, you're modeling a lot of bad civic lessons. If you're much more interested in teamwork and want the kids to run the team to a degree, not necessarily making the coaching decisions, but coming up with the money and fundraising and those kinds of things, then you've made it into a civic opportunity. Some coaches are beginning to organize themselves to think about both ethics and also civic engagement.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on raising informed citizens.
For an audio CD of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $15 with your name, mailing address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C. 20021. 1-5.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Peter Levine about raising informed citizens. How can we help our kids maintain interest and involvement when it's not a political season? There's not a lot going on politically some years.
Well, I think one thing is we should capitalize on when it is a political season, which is a great opportunity for discussion and for thinking about issues. And of course, it's a political season more often than we think at first, because presidential years are once every 4 years, but there's usually an election every year in the fall, much lower profile. But besides that, I mean, there's a lot more to citizenship than voting. So the other times are great times to think about activism and organizing and service and following the news and commenting on the news and discussing.
And I would guess what you're saying also is the local stuff is what could get the kids excited, whether there's going to be funding for the new high school gymnasium and that kind of thing.
We tend to forget the local stuff in teaching. It's not in the curriculum very often. It's very often not on the test. So, for example, if you take American government in high school, you're probably going to be dealing with a high school textbook which is all about the federal government, or which has a little section in a generic way about how we also have states in America and stuff, but it won't talk about your state.
So one thing that parents could push for is somewhere in the curriculum, someplace where it's appropriate for the kids to learn about how their state government came to be and how the town government came to be.
Yeah, and what's going on in the town right now too. I mean, you want to teach in a nonpartisan way, but you do want to teach about the issues. If there's a landfill problem or a school dropout problem or something, you want those things to be in the curriculum as well.
How active were high school students, for example, in some of the local things that were big? I was just thinking about Love Canal, you know, the pollution in that town. But I'm sure there are lots and lots of stories like that.
There are lots of stories. And so I don't know what to say about a generalization. The civil rights movement comes to mind, where there were people right at the very forefront, mostly college. I mean, I think about the first sit-ins begun by college students, but they were only 18 years old. And there were certainly high school students who were right on the forefront of desegregation, the ones who actually had to walk into the door of the high school in Little Rock. So that immediately comes to mind. Civil rights movement had a very deliberate, special feeling about youth, which we don't always have. So I don't know about Love Canal. I don't know about the environmental movement in general.
Although I would think the environmental movement, probably because it's something kids can think about recycling and some of the stuff on a basic level, they could get involved. The question is, were they involved in the big crises that were coming up?
Some of these schools that are green schools that are really good for the environment, the kids that go to them seem to be very, very proud about that. And I guess they've learned a lot in the process.
And again, going to college instead of high school, because I just don't know about high school in this respect, but college students are real leaders on these efforts to get the colleges themselves to cut their carbon emissions and become better for the environment, which is a powerful thing. I mean, there's a lot of really urgent work on that, and it may be that American universities will become quite efficient.
It occurs to me, not having been a teacher for many years, but that science classes in the elementary schools could be wonderful labs, quote unquote, for kids to learn about environmental practices that are significant, and that would be a civic engagement, perhaps.
Yes, so they can do environmental monitoring. They can take water samples. They can try to figure out why the stream is polluted, and it's a very powerful thing. And there are groups like Earth Force that do this. Earth Force is in a lot of schools as a formal part of the curriculum.
There are a lot of ideas floating around here, and we're sure that the parents listening are going to come up with their own. But before we close, in addition to your book, The Future of Democracy, Developing the Next Generation of American Citizens, what resources would you suggest for our listeners who want to pursue further some of the issues we've been discussing?
It's very good for families to talk about issues and politics. I'd say in a neutral way, I don't think you want to indoctrinate your kid to vote the way you did, for example, but to get them thinking about it. And there's a lot of good resources for kids to talk about politics. The news media does a mixed job itself. So your local newspaper might or might not have resources. The Washington Post, for example, does have the Kids Post, and it's very good. And it might, by the way, be something to ask the news media to do in your community. But there are some more generic or national sources. One example would be the Public Agenda Foundation. This would be better for high school because it's not written for little kids. But Public Agenda has issue guides on major issues that are neutral. They'll always give you at least three different perspectives on an issue, but they're very well organized. I think just plain reading your regular adult newspaper with your kid a little bit not reading the whole article, obviously, but just going over some of the things that are in the newspaper is very valuable. We know that families where the newspaper is read produce much stronger citizens. If you're interested in actually becoming an activist for civic engagement, then it's definitely worth contacting the Center for Civic Education, which is a national organization, has state teams in a lot of states that have volunteers working on trying to change state and local education policy. If you're more interested in how parents can be involved or communities be involved in schools, then the Public Education Network, or PEN, is a great resource.
Well, this is a lot of information, mm-hmm. but you have been a wonderful resource. So, Peter Levine, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of Peter Levine's book, The Future of Democracy, Developing the Next Generation of American Citizens. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. And please spell anything that's not obvious. That's a big help to us. Mention show number 366 and tell us, if you can, what station you're tuning into.
Visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org, where you can even listen to a show of your choice. This is Sandy Bird and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents Perspective. Our sound engineer is Drew Chapp. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.